A quick word from our sponsor, Oakstone CME's ACP Mix App Audio Companion. You know that feeling when you open up a CME app and get totally lost in menus, modules? I don't have time for that. Or I've had times prepping for an oncology service or a cardiology service and wanted to refresh on that particular specialty and just didn't have time to read. And that's why I love the Mix App ACP Audio Companion from Oakstone CME. They have done board prep to earning CME and made it so user-friendly with their mobile platform. It really offers a trusted audio content designed for learning on the go. It's smooth, intuitive, built for real-life use, and I can track my progress, save my place, download content to listen offline, whether I'm walking to the hospital, folding laundry, you name it. For 50 years, Oakstone CME has helped busy clinicians stay current with expert-led education free of outside commercial influence. You can multitask while you absorb the latest medical knowledge with MixApp ACP Audio Companion. It's a podcast-style tool, so you can listen at 1.5x, 2x. It's packed with expert insights, board prep, and more CME credit than ever, so you can stream and download at any time. And as a special that's exclusive just for Core AM listeners, you can use the code CORE25. If you go to oakstone.com/MKSAP, you can use the code CORE25 to get 25% off. And with that, let's get into the episode.
There is a saying in interventional radiology that IR is like a bank robbery. You have to figure out how to get in, get out, and get away with it.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Weinstein, an interventional radiologist at Beth Israel. And today, we are talking all about the mysteries of interventional radiology, aka IR, and IR drains.
So I can sometimes sense a certain amount of trepidation and nervousness when I get a consult about a malfunctioning drain from IM doctors. And so part of why I'm excited for this episode is to help demystify the everyday basics of some of what we do in IR.
And that is Dr. Olumide Ololade, an interventional radiology fellow at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Welcome to the Core AM Thigh Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Tony Chan, a resident at BI. And I'm excited to explore some pearls about working with IR today. It's always been such a black box for me.
I hear you on that. Let's get started on the five questions we'll be covering today. Test yourself by pausing after each of the five questions. And remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl number one, nuances of imaging.
When is the ultrasound versus CAT scan versus MRI more helpful in consulting IR and for which parts of the body?
Pearl number two, pre-procedural planning.
What factors go into the IR pre-op evaluation?
Pearl number three, drain placement and removal.
When do drains go in and when do they come out?
Pearl number four, troubleshooting drains.
When a patient is having trouble with a drain, what are things we can do before we call interventional radiology?
Pearl number five, outpatient IR.
What does the outpatient IR follow-up entail? And what does a capping trial of a PCN tube entail?
So I think the IR consult for us often begins with some sort of abnormal imaging finding. But at the same time, I've also noticed that they'll call back and sometimes ask for additional imaging as well. So we wanted to dig deeper into why IR might ask for one study versus the other.
Yeah, so let's get into a couple of the nuances we found out. Starting with one of the more common scenarios that comes up, we're trying to detect a bleed and where it's coming from.
So we sat down with Dr. Quinn Meisinger, an IR physician at UC San Diego, who just happens to be the president-elect of the Society of Interventional Radiologists.
So one of the most important things for bleeding assessment, if you are trying to identify a bleed, is multi-phase, usually CT imaging.
So when I heard that, I scratched my head, honestly. I usually just order a CTA for a GI bleed. So that got me thinking, what does multi-phase imaging mean?
We also need to have a non-contrast study with no IV contrast and no oral contrast to get a baseline as to either are there pills in there with calcium, there are bright spots that are already in the bowel, are there calcifications in diverticula? The idea is that there can be things that can sort of fake us out, and we don't want to take someone for a procedure that they really weren't. And then when we get the dye in the arterial phase, we'll see it in the arteries. And then if we see any dye in the bowel that was not seen before we gave the dye that is now seen, that means in the arterial phase of contrast that there's an artery that's contributing to the bleeding that's going to the bowel. And so then that is highly useful for us. And then we can watch on the venous phase to see if it continues to grow. The venous phase is more delayed in time. Grow, or we call it blooming, or more accumulate, which will give us a sense as to the rate and confirm that this bleeding is active and ongoing.
So it sounds like in multi-phase imaging, the first phase is the non-contrast CT, the baseline image. Then the second phase is the arterial phase where contrast gets pumped out of the heart. And without the first non-contrast study as our roadmap, it would be difficult to separate active extravasation of contrast from, say, calcifications or existing dense stuff in the bowel like pills or food. And if IR does see extravasation, then the third phase, which is the delayed or venous phase, is going to help us confirm that extravasation continues to grow and gives us a sense of the rate of bleeding as well as ongoing activity.
And, you know, the other thing I didn't appreciate until this episode was how carefully the radiology techs are working behind the scenes to time the CTs in terms of giving the contrast and then shooting the image.
So the patient gets injection of IV contrast. The CT technologist times it to say it's about 40 seconds after the injection in the arm. It can be different if they have a PICC because then it's going immediately to the atrium. So the technologist is usually making an assessment based on when to time with CT. For those of you who all read CTs, you sometimes will see the diagnostic radiologist say, oh, this was not timed appropriately because of whatever. And that's generally because there's some sort of thing that they didn't suspect. The patient had heart failure. They didn't pump out the contrast.
So that's a great teaching point that timing the contrast injection for a patient's cardiac output could really affect imaging quality. It makes sense in hindsight, though, since if a patient's ejection fraction is really, really low, then the heart's going to take longer to pump that contrast into systemic circulation. And at the end of the day, you really want to be capturing an image that actually has contrast in the phase that we need it in.
Great. So with that, let's move on to the nuances of ultrasound. And here I want to move on to clot. So we sat down with Dr. Oz Ahmed, an IR physician at University of Chicago, to help break down a little bit more.
Chronic DVT specifically is a misnomer in the sense that if something is truly chronic, like years long, it's actually, there's no DVT. The vein is actually atretic and sort of scarred down. And when I say a clot, I mean, is it any clot, subacute, acute, chronic, versus a truly chronic occlusion, like what we call like a CTO, those true chronic occlusions, what you actually do see is a ton of collaterals. Now, as a, you know, internist or on the medicine side, that may manifest as, you know, severe leg swelling, collaterals. That sort of speaks to a very chronic process.
So when we say chronic thrombotic occlusion, it's not like there is hard chronic clot that has been sitting there for 5 years and just stayed there. The body doesn't really work that way. It'll always continuously try to dissolve that clot and get it away. But the constant sort of continuous formation of clot in that particular area, say your fempop or like your iliofemoral, causes the vein to become scarred down and basically destroys the vein. And so you basically just have really scarred down, narrowed vein wall that has now that doesn't allow blood to flow through. And then it feeds on itself, right? Because the more the vein continues to scar, the narrower the lumen becomes, the slower the blood flows, the more likely you are to form acute clot there. And then it just kind of feeds on itself as a cycle.
And sometimes I've also noticed consultants ask for a CTV or CT venogram for a clot over Doppler ultrasound and never fully understood why.
Usually CTV is going to be very good for sort of the pelvis and the IVC and things that are too deep for ultrasound. Ultrasound is probably good, cheaper, without any radiation penalty, and you can interact with the vein itself, put color Doppler on it, squish it, look at that things to try and define the clot. If there is any with ultrasound, with the caveat that it is operator dependent. So if they skip a segment and didn't take a picture and there was a clot in there, theoretically possible, there could be a DVT, but the operator missed it in going by it. Whereas a CAT scan, multiple people can scroll through, everything's been saved. And so every image can be scrutinized.
Nice. So CTV is going to be helpful for more of those deeper clots in the pelvis or IVC.
And then compared to ultrasound, CTV does have some contrast involved.
There's almost no other really broad indication that I can think of where I would say, like, I definitely don't need or want contrast. I'd always welcome IV contrast because it allows us to see the vessels, and it also allows us, I'm thinking of now non-vascular interventions like abscess drain placement, things like that. Again, it allows you to sort of see the vascularity that you may need to potentially avoid when you do a needle-guided intervention. And it also sort of helps evaluate whether something is a mass versus an abscess. Now, that doesn't mean we do every single thing with contrast. If the referring service says, look, we can't give this person contrast, then we do what we can, you know, whether that's half-dose contrast or just evaluate without. Similarly, like, if it's just like a follow-up scan, right? Like we place an abscess drain, now we just want to see what the collection looks like.
Great. So basically, IV contrast helps us understand vascular blood flow, which is going to be important for any proceduralist. One caution, though, with getting IV contrast that we learned about is if the patient has just gotten PO contrast. PO contrast could make everything that we just talked about significantly more complicated. For example, I'm thinking about a situation where patient comes in for abdominal pain, gets PO contrast to evaluate for an obstruction, and then later develops a GI bleed.
So if they got a regular CT where they were given PO contrast, the bowel's already going to be full with bright stuff from the oral contrast they've taken. And now it doesn't even matter in the phases. We're not going to be able to tell if more bright stuff is going into bright stuff.
Bright stuff on bright stuff. So that is a tough situation indeed. Now let's switch gears to the MRI. I'm glad we're talking about when an MRI is or isn't helpful, because if an MRI is ordered, that often means patients are waiting at least a day or two to get that MRI done.
Yes. Unfortunately, I think we've all been there on wards. I know MRI is great for evaluating soft tissue changes. That's why we'll order it, for example, when there's concern for a ligament injury or when we're concerned about cholangitis, but the CT read isn't a slam dunk. So then we go for MRCP.
And so when do we really need to know about those soft tissue changes with an MRI?
Really, anytime you need to have a high-res picture of the soft tissue anatomy, or if you're looking for these like more subtle signs of inflammation, MRI is really good at picking up those things. So in the example we just talked about, we might see dilated ducts on CT concerning for cholangitis, but the MRCP, which is basically an MRI of the abdomen focused on the biliary and pancreatic systems, that's going to be the best imaging modality to help us see any obstructions in the biliary duct, like mass or inflammation surrounding soft tissue or a biliary stone that just might not be as well characterized on a CT or right upper quadrant ultrasound.
Great. And then on the flip side, we do want to highlight that MRI does not always mean better.
Believe it or not, MR overcalls fluid all the time. It's so sensitive for fluid. That's the point of MR. T2-weighted MR sequences are really sensitive to fluid. So they will very much overestimate the amount of fluid. You may see an MR report on a lumbar spine that recently had surgery, and they'll say, oh, there's three big fluid collections. So I usually say to providers, get an ultrasound, and that actually tells us if it's drainable or even big enough to. And that's probably happens to me about once a week.
Wow, that's a pretty helpful tip. So CT sounds like it's almost like a strong flashlight in the woods at night. It's going to give you a good sense of the major structures, but it can miss finer details. Whereas MRI is like night vision goggles. It's incredibly sensitive. It's going to pick up on the smallest changes. But in that same vein, it can also lead to more artifact, like mistaking a rustling bush for an animal.
All right, so on the topic of MRI, let's say we have a patient who has a pathologic fracture. I've had consulting teams ask for an MRI, and then it makes me scratch my head a little bit, like, why are they asking for an MRI for bone things that the MRI was better for soft tissue things?
So a way to know whether a fracture is acute is if there is edema, and the only way to be able to see edema is with an MRI, not with a CT or an ultrasound. Usually something like a kyphoplasty would work best for acute or subacute fractures. If it's a chronic fracture, you're not going to be able to treat that with the kyphoplasty most likely.
Ha. Okay, I see. All right. So it sounds like if radiology sees a line somewhere in the spine that's worrisome for a fracture, the next step would be to see if there's edema, which is really going to be where the MRI is going to be helpful. MRI is going to show us, hey, this is a fresh fracture, has acute edema around it, and it might warrant IR to possibly do something like a kyphoplasty down the line.
Exactly. Lots of great learning points already. Big picture, it seems like so far we found that one, not all imaging is equally helpful before consulting IR, especially any concern for GI bleeding. Think about getting multi-phase imaging to avoid false positives. It's also a good learning point for me to think about how other factors like cardiac output and prior PO contrast administration can negatively impact the quality of our safety images.
I guess the implication for all of us is to really make sure we're putting the ejection fraction in our one-liner when we're ordering those CAT scans.
Finally, MRI can be really useful when you want to check for inflammation or edema that's just not going to be seen as well on CT or ultrasound. Just be aware of its tendency to overcall fluid collections.
So now that we know a little bit more about some nuances of different imaging, let's get into the pre-op planning part of it. I think so many times we've been there where, you know, patients are sick, surgery is telling us the patient's too sick for surgery, poor surgical candidate, and we reach out to IR instead.
So even before getting into pre-op planning, Dr. Meisinger brought up a really humbling reminder on the importance of actually counseling patients and families on whether they should be getting that IR procedure in the first place.
I have to be honest with them as I say, hey, here's your option. You're a cholecystostomy tube. You're an 88-year-old with congestive heart failure, and you've had a bunch of MIs, and you're on an intense anticoagulant that we can't take you off for this procedure. So yeah, most surgeons wouldn't want to operate on somebody with that kind of morbidity. But I say, and I have to be honest with them, as I say, hey, this is going to probably save your life in the temporizing, but you may have this tube for life. And so that is something that's usually lost with patients, is that they think that we maybe fix them temporarily, but then comes the issues postoperatively when patients have tubes for the rest of their life. So we do a lot of tube maintenance, of course, as well. But often that's something where we tell patients where they show up on down in the interventional suite, or we see them on the floor and say, hey, you've been sent for a PCI. Did you know you're going to probably have this for the rest of your life? And they say, oh, I've never been told that. So that's part of our informed consent as well, as expectations, how patients are going to do. So we tend to have a lot of patients that were just delayed, potentially death, not necessarily always saving them.
What a great reminder on our part in the expectation setting as well. I'd hate the idea of a patient getting all the way down to IR and the IR suite before realizing that their drain is going to be permanent, or a procedure is just going to prolong their suffering in the long run if that's not what they want.
Yeah, I think a lot of this comes back to the fact that IR and IR tubes are a black box for us. So hopefully this episode will help a little bit in the counseling, but I think the other part of it is also just being a leader and being able to kind of delegate and or even just close a loop, being like, hey, urology, thanks so much for saying the next step is PCN, but I just want to know a little bit more. Is this temporary or more permanent? And then I'm just curious, will you be talking to the patient about this, or should our team? And then what do you think is best for the patient and how they could hear it?
Okay, so let's say patient is counseled appropriately.
Yay.
Let's chat about pre-op labs, anticoagulation, and of course, NPO. Obviously, grab the things that will affect bleeding risk and renal function, just like you would for any surgical patient. So PT, INR, PTT, platelets, and creatinine.
Yes. And speaking of coags, I just want to clarify for patients who have liver disease or heme malignancies that their coags are not going to look that pretty. And thankfully, coags may not correlate to actual bleeding risk.
The biggest thing that you'll see in terms of the change from when the first guidelines came out in 2011 to 2019 updates is really our liver failure patients and our low-risk procedures. I'll do a bone marrow biopsy with a platelet of one because these patients usually have MDS or some sort of leukemia or something that's going on with regards to their hematologic malignancy. And so they need to get it, and their bleeding risk is very low. Paracentesis, I really don't care what their INR platelets are, particularly if they're cirrhotic. If they need it, they need it.
Of course, at the end of the day, comfort with pre-op labs is really up to that proceduralist, and everyone has different viewpoints and experiences.
IR can be wildly different. The complexity, the tools that they use, the approach that they use can have different levels of risk and sophistication, and not every hospital has the same tools, and so they may do things differently.
Now, on the do we stop the blood thinner the night before or the morning of question, of course, it's always helpful, like we've been saying throughout this episode, to talk with your IR colleagues who are doing the procedure on what they feel comfortable with. There is, however, a beautiful infographic from the Gray Matters episode on AFib that also summarizes three helpful branch points, I think, to think about. So one, how pressing is the indication for the blood thinner? Two, what are the suggested number of days to hold that particular form of anticoagulation? And three, how high risk is this procedure?
So I would say that whenever you're making a puncture from outside the body and you're puncturing an organ, that is a high bleeding risk procedure. So any kind of a new gastrostomy tube, a new PCN, a new cholecystostomy tube, these are all high bleeding risk procedures that require any kind of percutaneous biopsy. A liver biopsy, for example, is a high bleeding risk procedure. A lymph node biopsy, if it's very superficial and it's in the inguinal region, for example, that's not a high bleeding risk procedure because lymph nodes are not super vascular. So in general, yes, any kind of new puncture will be a high bleeding risk procedure. A routine exchange of a PCN or any kind of tube is not a high bleeding risk procedure, and probably anticoagulation does not need to be stopped for those.
There's an SIR, Society of Interventional Radiology app, where all the guidelines in terms of how we manage anticoagulation. However, we've changed one thing, and that's generally our management of ports. The guidelines say, oh, you can continue DOACs and stuff like that for ports, where we find a lot of times patients get hematomas within their port site pockets and stuff like that. So we tend to be a little bit more conservative.
So I actually have the SIR app on my phone, and it really does cover anticoagulation for like every single IR procedure out there and more. It even touches on antibiotics pre-procedurally for some of them too, which is interesting.
Yeah, and we get no kickbacks for shouting out the app. So Tony definitely does actually have this on our phone and use it. You know, I appreciate Dr. Meisinger's point about the caution with DOACs when it comes to management with ports. I'm curious about antiplatelet meds, aspirin, clopidogrel. What are we doing with those?
We pretty much rule the platelet inhibition. So like aspirin and Plavix, most of us will do majority of procedures regardless of whether or not they're on it. Obviously aspirin. Much lower risk in terms of that, in terms of Plavix. And then, of course, we're getting into the more higher powered platelet inhibitors like Brilinta and stuff like that. But there is a risk assessment on us, and most IR providers don't care about aspirin if they've been on it.
I was really surprised to hear that IR feels comfortable doing procedures on Plavix. And the teaching point for me is that in low risk procedures, IR guidelines say you don't have to stop any anticoagulation or antiplatelets. And so what are those low-risk procedures? That's going to be typically things in the vein like an IBC filter, lymph node biopsy, port placement. And again, the caveat to all of this, kind of like the running theme of our episode, is that it's, again, of course, up to the proceduralist and how comfortable they might feel doing a procedure on Plavix. So always worth checking in with a local IR team.
Okay, so before we wrap up our second pearl, I feel like we have to talk about making patients MPO. I always feel so terrible for our inpatients who are sometimes starving from midnight to 4 p.m., sometimes multiple days in a row, while they're waiting for an inpatient IR slot to open up.
Yeah, absolutely. It is the worst. And on top of that, it is crazy to me that the American Society of Anesthesiologists have guidelines from 1998 saying that clear liquids are fine up to 2 hours prior to sedation on any patient who is low aspiration risk. And of course, at the same time, I also understand the aspect that inpatient, it's really hard to know when someone's gonna be called on, when there's gonna be an emergency, or when a slot might open. So that is also tough too.
For sure. And if it's tough for us to project, I can only imagine how much tougher it is for the patient who's actually the one being MPO. I will say one win I've seen at some medical centers is that they've updated their local policies to say okay for a clear liquid diet at 2 a.m. and then MPO at 8 a.m. for procedures where only moderate sedation is required. So basically, patients can have a clear tray for breakfast, which can be something like coffee at the very least.
Great. And speaking of moderate sedation, some people like to call it conscious sedation, or I've even heard twilight sedation. Can you walk me through the different types of sedation?
So let's start with moderate sedation. We can tell most patients getting an IR procedure, just as a benchmark, it's a little less intense than what they'd be getting typically for like a routine colonoscopy.
I think our version of moderate sedation may be less than I think a lot of other specialties, because this is just more anecdotally talking to like my GI colleagues and stuff. Their version of moderate sedation is 5 of Versed and like 300 of Fent or something. For us, it's like 1 or 2 milligrams of Versed and like 100 mics of Fent. And that's sort of a typical patient.
Okay. So it sounds like most things in IR is going to be moderate sedation, similar to what someone might get at a colonoscopy or probably less, or minimal sedation, which is just one sedative agent. So then what falls under the deep sedation bucket? You know, I feel like always a patient's asking like, hey, doc, like, am I going to get a tube down my throat? Am I going to like have to go under, quote unquote?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anything where there's like a needle like going through an organ, not like a biopsy, we're connecting like a hepatic vein to a portal vein. And it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of like a blind stick and things like that, where you basically need the patient very still. There's like a precision needed there. The ablations tend to hurt, you know, tend to be painful. And you also need patients to be really still. So almost all of our ablations are done with general anesthesia. Then again, some of this stuff also depends on comorbidities. Even then, for an IR procedure, they may be too sick to get moderate sedation. So those patients a lot of times will also get anesthesia consults for as well. So like portal vein recanalization, you know, IVC recanalization, you know, anything near the heart where you're taking needles. So like SVC, sharp recanalization, things like that, where like there's a real chance of death.
Okay. So yeah, when it's a real chance, definitely good to have some anesthesia on board.
So just to recap our second pearl, before your patient actually goes for that IR procedure, talk with them and their family and other involved consultants who may also be asking for an IR intervention about how those short-term benefits actually fit within their long-term goals of care. Never be afraid to ask your consultants as well about what pre-op labs they want, as well as whether you should hold anticoagulation and antiplatelet agents, but just also know that there's an SIR app out there that can be a really useful resource as well. Finally, it's important to think ahead and touch base with our IR colleagues about what the sedation plan is and how we can therefore maybe avoid unnecessary NPO time, knowing that patients can often be NPO 2 hours before the procedure if it's just moderate sedation.
Okay, so for the next pearl, we want to ask, when do drains go in and when do they come out? And first things first, how do we even know if something what we see on imaging is actually even amenable to drainage in the first place?
So yeah, the biggest thing in terms of T is when you see a fluid collection, is there actually a component of walls? So when a lot of radiologists use the term phlegmon usually means just fluid that's kind of interspersed. That generally means that there's not a focalized collection that allows us to put a drain in or actually say it. I will say, let's get an ultrasound of that area because we need to see if it's liquefied, because you can't put a drain still as things are developing. So the biggest thing is making sure there's liquefaction and it's something that's rounded or walled off.
Okay, so the main thing to know is when we consult IR for a potentially drainable collection, for it to be successful, it needs to have a component of a wall with internal liquefaction. Otherwise, it's just a phlegmon, aka interspersed fluid, that's not amenable to either drainage or aspiration.
Yes. And then fast forward a little bit in time, I feel like sometimes we send a patient down to get an abscess aspirated, and then they come back with a drain we didn't expect.
And all of this just goes back into how we kind of talk to our patients about the procedure they might be getting and leaving some room for flexibility. One of our reviewers, Dr. Pavlis, very memorably said when reviewing this episode, you know, we often triage by radiology these days, and the read may say one thing, but once they get in there, there might be a different assessment.
Drains generally are left behind when there's infected fluid or we think the fluid's going to reaccumulate. Usually, if it's under 3 centimeters, we're probably just going to try to aspirate it and just remove the fluid and not leave a drain. However, there's circumstances where we suspect fluid is going to reaccumulate. So if it's adjacent to the bowel for diverticulitis, then I think that there's potential leakage coming from the bowel. We generally place a drain regardless of the size. And so definitely if it's infected, definitely if it's large, definitely if it's viscous, we usually need a drain to do that. So we'll place the drains.
Yeah. Okay. So less than 3 centimeters, we can feel comfortable that it can be done with a one and done aspiration event.
Yes, typically where those scenarios are happening with a drain being left in when we didn't expect, that's because there's a high chance of reaccumulating infected fluid. So, you know, if it's right next to the bowel in diverticulitis, or if IR is aspirating and they notice very viscous fluid coming out, that's just going to be hard to drain in one shot and needs a drain in place for a longer amount of time. So all of those things may lead to a drain being placed regardless of abscess size. Of course, after all of this, patient finally gets a drain. I feel like that's when everyone from the patient to nursing to case management starts asking, when is that drain going to come out? Of course, this is going to depend on the reason for the drain in the first place.
Yeah. And I always like asking IR, hey, what should we be shooting for? And a lot of times it's, hey, page us when the drain has less than, say, 10 cc's per day for 2 days. We'll come up and take the drain out. Or, yeah, we're going to need repeat imaging to look for interval change after that point.
Okay. So to recap, what I want folks to take away is don't be surprised when a patient comes back with a drain. Be curious. Is it because when IR got in there, the abscess was actually over 3 centimeters, or was it in an area with a high chance of reaccumulation? Or did they notice that the fluid was more viscous than expected and couldn't easily be drained out just in one go?
If you're in healthcare, you've probably heard of FIGS. And if you haven't heard of them, let me just say, total game changer. These scrubs are actually specifically made for us doctors, residents, students, all of us putting in long hours and needing gear that can actually keep up. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-out room looking way more put together after a night shift. And yep, it was FIGS. And I finally tried it myself. And honestly, they live up to the hype. They're lightweight, they're breathable, stretchy, like scrubs that are actually made to move with you, not against you. The fit is clean, modern, but quite functional. Tons of smart pockets, which I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and actually antimicrobial fabric that is built for the real clinical life. And it's more than just scrubs. FIGS is helping outfit healthcare workers around the world. They have their Threads for Threads initiative, which is awesome, and I love that they give back. So whether you're in the ED, rounding, grabbing groceries post-call, FIGS shows up for you. Go to wearfigs.com and use the code FIGSRX to get 15% off your first order. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. And with that, let's get back to the episode. A quick word from our sponsor, Washington Red Raspberries. These days, it's easy to not really know where our food actually came from, but there's something really grounding to knowing the story behind what's on your plate. I recently learned that 90% of American-grown frozen red raspberries comes from a tight-knit group of family farmers in Washington state. Generations of families who've dedicated their lives to growing berries with care, and it shows. These raspberries are frozen right at peak ripeness, which means every time I toss it into a smoothie after a long shift or sprinkle into some yogurt, they taste just as fresh as the day they were picked. No additives, just pure, real flavor and nutrition. You can find frozen Washington red raspberries in the frozen fruit section of most major grocery retailers. You can check the label and see quote-unquote products of the U.S. It's also pretty popular products like Smucker's raspberry jam or the Smucker's Uncrustables with the red raspberry filling. To learn more and hear the stories of the farmers behind these incredible berries, head to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. There's also recipes as well as the retailers that carry these delicious berries. So check out the link in the show notes. And with that, let's get back into the episode.
Now we get to my favorite part of this episode, troubleshooting drains. I think there is a lot of nervousness around caring for drains, both from the physician side as well as from nurse.
Yeah, I've definitely been there too. And sometimes I feel like at a loss when I get a page that doc, this drain's clogged or it's become more painful for the patient. I think a lot of that comes from being expected to know what to do about it and having knowledge gap.
Yes, clearly we're all learning here. Dr. Olilade kindly also has a really good summary on how to troubleshoot malfunctioning drains if someone from IR can't come by immediately to help.
So as an example, I got a call mid-case about a patient whose PCN was suddenly not draining anymore. And so, you know, came out of case, called back and said, oh, did you flush the tube? I don't know how to do that. What's the response that I got back? And I was like, okay, sounds good. Did you look at the tube? And they're like, well, I don't know how to evaluate a tube. So I would say that's something that any clinician really can do is troubleshoot a tube. And I would say, you know, when I went to go see that patient finally to go find out what was going on, what had happened was that they had redressed the, they had changed the dressings on the tube. And in changing the dressing on the tube, they basically folded the tube onto itself and it was just kicked under the patient. And so all that needed to be done was basically undress it, take off the cape, and just, you know, dress it back. I think that's possibly a delay in patient care, right? Because you have a patient who suddenly doesn't have any drainage from the tube. And the only reason is because it's kinked underneath them or it's clamped in some kind of way and they forgot to unclamp it after flushing it. We as IRs, we may not have the opportunity to get to that patient's bedside immediately. And I have seen patients come through the emergency room, have clamped drains and are getting septic from that. And it's sort of like, well, all you had to do is just unclamp this and it would be fine. And so I think that there is a lot of benefits to any clinician being able to do the basic troubleshooting of an IR drain, which is basically, well, what does the tubing look like? Does it flush well? Is everything unkinked? Are there any, you know, is anything clamped in it?
So say we've checked the PCN externally, though, and one, it's not kinked, and two, it's already unclamped, but it's still painful, it's still not draining. How do I know that there isn't still a blockage or that the drain hasn't come dislodged? Is it still safe to flush?
Flushing really is just take a 10cc syringe, attach it to whatever flushing mechanism that comes with the drain, and open up the port so that the fluid flows towards the drain and push. And if you get a lot of resistance, or if the patient has pain with that, or if it starts to leak from the site where the drain is going into the patient's body, then you know that something is going wrong, right? But if it flushes smoothly, everything's flushing forward fine, then at least you've ruled out certain things, which is very helpful for us to know when we get the consult that, oh, a particular drain is not working well.
So most tubes, when they come through, particularly for biliary abscess and urinary, it's usually related because the tube is somewhat occluded from viscous fluid, incrustations, things like that. So usually you need to flush daily to maintain patency.
At this point about flushing, I remember too well from the tube feeds episode that I remember the GI doc talking about how often patients get discharged on tube feeds and they come back the very next day in the ER because they were told to flush after the tube feeds went through their G-tube or whatever enteral access they have. And maybe they were watching, like, you know, The Price is Right or some other really good show, and the feeds kind of got sticky in the tube. And by the time they get around to flushing, they already had a problem.
I would say that a good rule of thumb is if you're draining something that's very thick, if you're draining molasses, something that's a molasses texture, that's most likely more likely to get stuck in your drain and clog up your drain. I would probably flush that more often. If you're draining urine, then you could probably flush that less often. I would say once a day for something like that.
All right. So at the very least, we're going to try the 10cc flush. But honestly, I know some of this stuff is hard to visualize while listening to a podcast. So we will link a video in the show notes that actually has Dr. Almude kind of going through some of these, you know, basics of what to check, how to see clamped versus unclamped, because it's helpful to kind of have someone coach us through it.
We did want to clarify for listeners that aspirating fluid, aka pulling back with the syringe to see fluid return, is less helpful to IR. Just because you get something back doesn't rule out a blockage further down in the drain. And it can create some unwanted traction if there's a malfunction as well. So takeaway is try flushing, but less utility to aspirating.
All right, good to know. Okay, so what do you do if we do flush and it doesn't fix things, say, for example, with a PCN tube?
And then at the worst case scenario, then, you know, as a first line, you can also get a KUB, which is something that I often will recommend as the first line of imaging, because remember, at the end of every procedure, we take a picture of where the tube was at the end of the procedure. And so if you get a KUB and you compare the two and you see that the tube is completely retracted out or something like that, then we know that that's something is probably going to require some kind of intervention, whether urgent, emergent, or routine, to be quite fair.
Great. So to recap our fourth pearl on troubleshooting, this is especially important because IR might not always be available to see our patients right away. It's helpful for us to at least know some of the basics, right? Making sure the tube is not improperly clamped, having a low threshold to flush with a 10cc syringe, and then think about what imaging might be helpful to compare to a prior image and see if a drain might have migrated. And then finally, checking in with our patients and nurses to see how comfortable they've been feeling about drains and flushing on their own to help prevent any future clogs. All right, last but not least, let's get into outpatient interventional radiology follow-up. What are the things we should know when we're discharging a patient who needs a follow-up with IR?
So I think it never hurts to give patients supplies when they go home. I think that we never take, or I personally do not take for granted the fact that you're putting a drain that's going to be sticking out of somebody's body and they're going to have to go home and live with this somehow. I think that dressing supplies are always helpful in case the patient wants to change their dressing at some point. Flushes, I think, are also very helpful because patients do tend to run out of flushes very quickly, or they're not able to pick up flushes the very same day that they're going home. Maybe they're getting discharged at night, something like that.
I love this tip, especially because we just emphasize how important regular flushing is and also the reality of our healthcare system. Yes, we do our best to set up patients with VNA services, and yes, IR leaves these wonderful detailed drain instructions in their notes, but things don't always go as planned, right? Once patients leave the hospital and they get discharged, like think about on weekend days, or you know, how many patients have said, oh, their visiting nurse didn't come up or they didn't get the discharge instructions.
Agreed. We take such meticulous care of our patients inside the hospital.
Yes.
We worry about what happens when they're going to leave and have to manage all this stuff on their own, especially if it's a new drain. I personally always feel a little bit better knowing that some of them have outpatient IR clinic follow-up, but I'm curious how IR makes that determination of, you know, how long a patient is going to follow with them.
As it relates to drains, it really depends on what type of drain it is. Say it's a short-term drain for an abscess, right? We would, you know, potentially see that patient in clinic after a month or two to say, hey, what's your drainage output like? Has it gone down? Which would give you a sense that like, oh, this is healed. And then they can come into IR clinic and we can basically, you know, maybe you do some imaging to make sure that the abscess is truly gone, or you use your clinical judgment of like, well, yeah, it's been enough time and we're fairly sure that this is done. And we can just remove the drain in clinic at that point. In terms of drains that are staying in for the medium to long term, say by percutaneous cholecystostomy tubes or percutaneous nephrostomy tube, those patients, those drains are exchanged with us every 3 months to sort of reduce the risk of infection and also just to defer the possibility that the drain starts to malfunction or gets moved around and things of that nature.
So how then does IR determine when the drain comes out? I've heard them ask for capping trials for PCNs or biliary drains, but what does that entail?
But this is a situation where I think that having that sort of multidisciplinary understanding of what's going on with patients, especially from an IR perspective, is very important. And so when the patient comes in, you're always discussing with them, what has your cancer done in the meantime, right? Has it shrunk? You know, is there a possibility that we could do what we call a capping trial, which is basically to send you out with the drain capped, basically with the cover on it, so it's not draining outside. If we have a decent sense that things are draining inside and we do some intraprocedural imaging. And so in those kinds of situations, we may initiate a capping trial where the patient goes home for a week or two with the drains capped. And if they do well with that, no fever, chills, flank pains or anything like that, then we have, and they're making very good urine, then we have a good sense that, oh, this is a drain that maybe to come out, and then we bring them back within 1 or 2 weeks. We bring them into the anterior suite. We do a nephrostogram to make sure that things are flowing well. And as long as things are flowing well, then we can take out the drain at that point.
Gotcha. So it's a combination of one, imaging to confirm the original problem has resolved, and then two, capping the drain and monitoring the patient for at least a week to make sure they can drain internally without issues. And then finally, makes sense, you want to do a functional IR study like a nephrogram to triple check things are flowing well before taking the drain out permanently.
Yes. And then on the flip side, if the reason that they had the drain in first place isn't resolved, then things will certainly declare themselves.
The way that I think about this, anytime there's fluid in the body that's not moving, it's a nidus for infection. So there are two things that will happen. The body's reaction to that is the first thing, or the organ getting stressed by the fluid that's not moving, getting distended, pushing on the parenchyma, and your body's natural reaction to that is to say, hey, it's pain. So flank pain, side pain, whatever the case may be in that particular organ, right? The second thing is if that continues to fester, then you get a local infection in that area. And then eventually that infection spreads to the bloodstream. And then you get your sort of like serious reaction to that. And so I would say that pain, fever, chills, those are the things, you know, with a non-draining system, those are the things that, you know, usually trigger us to say, hey, you probably should come into the emergency room to get evaluated.
Okay, so let me take a stab at trying to synthesize everything we've learned this episode through a patient case, which is, you know, personally how I feel like things always really crystallize for me. Let's say you're on oncology and you admit this patient for vague symptoms. They get a CT. It turns out they have pyelonephritis from a new obstructive retroperitoneal mass. The team talks with the patient about a long-term PCN for source control, and the patient ultimately agrees that it's in line with their goals of care. IR does the procedure the following afternoon, and the patient's even able to drink some coffee for breakfast. Fast forward several months, and unfortunately, the patient comes back into your ED from home complaining about fever and, you know, doc, there's some decreased drainage from my chronic PCN. What next?
I would investigate, you know, and try to figure out what is causing this patient to have pain. What is patient causing this patient to have fever? Is the drainage adequate? Do they need a bigger drain in their kit, for example, right? Unlikely, you know, most of the time, whatever drain is put in is usually going to be adequate. In those situations, I will basically troubleshoot the drain and make sure that it's functioning as perfectly as I need it to function, which is it flushing very smoothly? Is it getting normal drainage out? I may even get a KUB again, just to sort of look and see, you know, is it in the right place? And if all those things check out, then my index of suspicion that the patient's drain is the culprit for causing, you know, the fever, for example, starts to go lower.
What a journey. And what a great example of, like, before jumping the gun to why this patient is having these SERS symptoms again, go back and check the basics and check the drain. Ah, love it.
And that brings us to the end of this episode.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you've gotten any value from this episode, our ask is to please, please share this with at least one other colleague who might also get something out of this episode too.
Thanks to Dr. John Pavlis, Dr. Jana Pelbaum, and Dr. Adam Strauss for reviewing this podcast. Thank you to Ivana Tang for the accompanying graphics. This episode was made as part of the digital education track at BIDMC.
Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you. Take care.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.